problem in many fields is that they have technical terms that sound self-explanatory and aren't. The world is full of people who think they understand the theory of relativity, except for the mathematical details. Right? The theory of relativity says everything is relative. I understand that. Similarly, in economics, with market failure. Market failure sounds as though it means markets failing, but in fact it doesn't. Market failure is in some sense about failure, but it is not really about markets. It's a problem that exists on markets, that exists in political institutions, that exists in firms, in armies, in families, in a more or less all human activities. A real and interesting problem. And what I'm going to try to do tonight is first to explain what market failure is, then to show why it is indeed a legitimate argument against the free market, and then to argue that it is an even stronger argument against the alternatives to the free market. That is, that market failure really is a way in which free markets can fail, but that it is a way in which the alternatives, which basically are political arrangements, are even more likely to fail. So let me start out with my favorite example of market failure. I want you to imagine that it's about 1,000 years ago and about 5,000 miles east of here, and you are one of a line of men with spears, several thousand men with spears, and your spears are all pointed that way. And the reason your spears are all pointed that way is that over that way, there are several thousand men on horses, and they've got spears too, and they're coming this way. And you do a very quick cost-benefit calculation. And you say to yourself, if all of us stand and keep our spears solidly pointed at them, if we're lucky, we can break their charge, and some of us will die, but most of us will live. If we run, horses run faster than we do. So I should stand. I made a mistake. I said we. I don't control him and him. I only control me. If all of them stand and I stand, we might break their charge and I might live. If all of them stand and I run, I almost certainly will live. If all of them run and I stand, the story is over. If all of them run and I run, I've got at least a little bit of a chance that I can run faster than they do and get away while they're getting killed. Whatever they're going to do, I should run. Everyone does the calculation, everyone runs, and most of them die. Welcome to the dark side of rationality. All right, I have just described a situation where each person is correctly calculating how to act in his own interest and where they're all worse off as a result. And that fundamentally is market failure. Market failure describes those situations where individual rationality does not lead to group rationality. And there are lots and lots of other examples. One of my other favorite examples actually happened, I suppose, within an hour of here, just south of UCLA, where I used to teach, where there was an intersection of two many-lane highways, which the locals claimed was the busiest intersection in the world. And every day, at least somewhere around rush hour, you saw the same thing happening, that cars would come this way until the light turned, and they'd try to get across, and they would jam the intersection. And light changes, the cars can't go this way because the intersection is full. Gradually, these cars trickle out just in time for these cars to jam the intersection and block it the other way. All right? Every driver was making the right choice. If you look at it from the standpoint of any single driver, if he had chosen to be well-behaved and not to go into the intersection until he was sure he could get across, he would have gotten home later. But if all the drivers had acted that way, they would all have gotten home earlier. So that's another example of exactly the same phenomenon of market failure. Those of you who've studied economics or game theory may be familiar with the prisoner's dilemma, and the prisoner's dilemma is sort of a toy version, a two-person version of exactly the same pattern. And you can offer lots and lots of examples. One of the interesting things about market failure is that whether or not you get market failure sometimes depends on the rules of the game you're playing. And that means that sometimes when you're constructing laws or designing firms or making rules for your children, You can engineer around market failure. You can create rules that don't give it to you. And my favorite example of that is a little puzzle that I like to give my audience. And it's a story. And the story is that two Bedouins are riding their camels through the Arabian desert with the oasis 3 miles away. And one of the Bedouin says to the other, "This camel I am riding, you've never seen such a camel. It's the slowest camel in all the deserts of Arabia." And the other Bedouin says, "You think your camel is slow? Let me tell you about this snail masquerading as a camel that I'm riding." Well, they got into an argument about it, and they decided on a bet that whichever one's camel got to the oasis last would win the bet, and the other one would pay him 1 golden dinar. Well, you can see what's going to happen. They start towards the oasis, and one of them goes slowly, and the other goes more slowly, and the other goes more slowly still, because both of them want to win their golden dinar, which requires getting to the oasis last. And the result is that an hour later, there are two Bedouins sitting their camels stock still in the blazing sun in the middle of the Arabian desert with the oasis 2 miles away. And at this point, a wise man comes walking by, and he looks at them and he says, "Why are you two idiots sitting your camels stock still in the middle of the Arabian desert in the blazing sun?" And they get off the camels to explain to him. And he whispers two words to them, and they jump back on the camels and race off for the oasis as fast as ever they can. What are the two words? Wise men are poor. What are the two words? Switch camels. All right, the bet was on which camel got last. So if I'm riding his camel and he's riding my camel, we've just reversed the incentives, and each one wants to go as fast as possible, not as slowly as possible. All right. So that's a nice example of how a little tiny tweak in the rules suddenly switched you away from market failure. What is the relevance of market failure to various issues in political economy and politics and stuff like that? And the immediate relevance, the way it usually is raised, is that economists offer it as an argument against laissez-faire, against a free market where everybody makes his own decisions. And the reason is that economists normally assume that individuals are rational, that they act rationally in their own interest. And if they act rationally, and if individual rationality leads to group rationality, then we're finished. We're home free. Let everybody do what he wants. We're all right. But market failures demonstrate that there are situations where individual rationality doesn't lead to group rationality. Hence, where if you have a laissez-faire society and everybody does what he wants, you won't, in fact, get the best possible result. And those of you who studied economics have probably been through the sort of standard list, whether or not they called the market failure. So one example is a public good. That's another case where the term sounds self-explanatory and isn't, because a public good does not mean a good produced by the public. Carrying the mail in the U.S. is not a public good. On the other hand, broadcasting a television show is a public good. What does public good mean to an economist? The central feature that makes something a public good is that the producer can't control who gets it. So that if you produce the good at all, it will be available to all the members of some pre-existing group of people. So if you broadcast your over-the-air television program, everybody within the range of your transmitter can listen to it, whether or not he has your permission. On the other hand, the post office can and does refuse to carry a letter unless it has a stamp on it. So even though that is produced by what used to be and to some extent still is a public organization, it is still a private good in the economist's sense. And the problem with public goods is how do you get them produced? Because the normal way that you produce ordinary goods in a free market is that I say to each of my customers, if you don't pay me for this, you can't have it. And if the value to them of what I'm producing is more than the cost of producing it, then I can sell it at a price at which I can more than cover my costs and make a profit. And if the value of what I'm producing is less than the cost of producing it, then I shouldn't be producing it. On net, we're worse off if we produce things that are worth less than they cost. So that sort of is the very, very simple kindergarten version of the beginning of a price theory course explaining why the market gets things done that ought to be done and doesn't get things that shouldn't be done. But it doesn't work for public goods. Because for the public good, when I say to you, don't pay me, if you don't pay me, you don't get it, you say, ha ha, you can't control whether I get it. You could decide not to produce it, and if nobody at all pays you, maybe you won't produce it, but there are 43 million people living within range of the broadcast, and I don't believe you if you say that my decision not to pay you is going to keep you from putting on that program. So, therefore, we have a serious problem in producing public goods. And the obvious conclusion is that the free market can't produce public goods, and therefore we need to have the government produce them. And the only trouble with that conclusion is that, in fact, the free market produces a whole lot of public goods. For example, radio and television broadcasts. And what is going on in each case is that someone has figured out one of several possible imperfect mechanisms, one of several possible kludges, as it were, by which they can get paid, perhaps not the full value of what they produce, but enough to cover the cost. And radio and television broadcasts are a particularly good example, because some, to me, unknown genius thought up the idea of producing not one public good, but two. One public good was one that had a positive cost to produce and a positive value to the customers. And that was called a radio program. And the other public good had a negative cost of production and a negative value to the consumers. And that was called an advertisement. And you tie the two tightly together and give away the bundle. And the amount the advertisers pay you pays you the cost of putting on your program. And the desirability of listening to the program pays your customers the cost of having to listen to the ads. All right, so that's one example. It's not a general solution. You couldn't produce all public goods that way. But that particular public good, in fact, can be produced that way. And there are a variety of other examples of public goods produced in other and imperfect ways. But this is an imperfect solution in the sense that there still may well exist public goods which are worth more than the cost of producing them and yet don't get produced. So in that sense, there really is market failure on the free market. There really are going to be cases where the free market doesn't do something that's worth doing. Another standard example of a form of market failure on the private market is what's called an externality. And that's a case where my action imposes either costs or benefits on third parties. And if it's a benefit, I can't get them to pay me for it. And if it's a cost, they can't make me pay them for imposing it on them. So that a fairly standard example is that you are in your dormitory and it's about midnight and you really like playing loud music. And you ignore the fact that three doors down, there is a student who's studying for his final exam tomorrow. And he doesn't like loud music. And so that would be a case where in making your decision of whether to play loud music, you take account of the benefits to you, but you ignore the costs to him. Now, of course, that could go the other way around. You could imagine a case where you, probably not nowadays, but a few decades back, where you have the only good hi-fi system in the dorm. And on the whole, you'd rather study, though you sort of like music too. But everybody else in the hall just loves the same music you do. So if you put on the loud music, you'd be producing a positive externality, a benefit to all of them, but you don't, because after thinking about it for a while, you decide you really have to study for that exam. So the general problem with an externality is that you will have things which are produced and shouldn't be because the person who makes the decision is getting all of the benefit but only paying part of the cost and therefore doesn't include that cost in his decision. And you get things that aren't produced and should be because the person making the decision pays all the cost but only gets some of the benefit and that's not enough benefit to make it worth doing. And as you can see, positive externalities sort of merge into public goods. It's not a somewhat fuzzy boundary between two ways of thinking about the same sort of problem. Now, externality problems, again, there are various imperfect solutions to them. One very common solution is bargaining, that the other people in the hall may be offered to do something for you if you'll play music that they like. A more formal solution is getting the activities involved all under one roof, organizationally speaking. So if you think about a bunch of stores and restaurants on such along a street, and there are some externalities there, that if I do a really good job of making, of putting on a restaurant that people like to come to, that's more customers passing by the other shops along the street who might come in and buy their goods. And you can think of a variety of other externalities along those lines associated with a street of shops. What is one way that everyone in this room is familiar with of getting those externalities taken account of internalizing those externalities? When you, in fact, go to a movie or a restaurant past a bunch of shops, quite often, where are you doing it? What? In a mall, exactly. And what is a mall? A mall is a privately owned piece of property, and the owner has an incentive to take account of those externalities. He has an incentive to go to the person who has a restaurant that will really pull in a lot of people and say, look, I'll give you a really cheap rent. Because if you're there, I can rent out at quite a good price to the shops that will be benefited by your customers. Similarly, somebody, you might say that having a parking lot next to the mall provides an externality because it makes it easier for the customers to come buy stuff. That's all right. The mall owner provides the parking lot. He doesn't have to worry about charging people, which would cost some money and require ticket takers and things, because he's going to get his money out of the extra rent that the people who have the stores in the mall are willing to pay because more people come because there's free parking. So if you think about it, one very common way of solving some of these problems is if my action imposes costs on you, if what I'm doing and what you're doing can be done by the same firm, that firm can take account of both costs and benefits and thus make the right decision. There's another example of a solution to this problem, which is actually sort of one of the legendary stories in the history of modern economics. And it has to do with bees. There is an economist, fairly prominent economist, Nobel Prize winner for other reasons, by the name of Mead. Sort of an odd and interesting name given this particular story. And he once pointed out that there were certain kinds of externalities which in principle might be taken care of by bargains among the parties, but there was just no practical way of doing it. And the example he offered involved money, bees. Because he said, bees browse on nectar from flowers. Hence, if you've got an apiarist here and a farmer here, or several farmers here, the farmer is producing an external benefit, namely when he grows crops that have blossoms the bees can browse on, and the farmer can't charge the bees for the privilege of browsing on his blossoms because bees don't respect property rights. The farmer can't put up a no trespassing sign and then say, only the bees that have paid me are allowed to browse on this. Sort of like a restaurant. Think of it as a bee restaurant. And therefore, Mead argued there would be an insufficient incentive for farmers to grow crops that were good for making honey. That was the basic argument. And he made this argument, and then a little later, some economists decided to actually look at the beekeeping industry. And it turned out that what Mead was saying was impossible had been standard practice in the industry for 100 years. Because while it is true that bees do not respect property rights, bees, like human beings, are lazy and fly as short a distance as they can. And so the standard arrangement was that when the farmers had crops in their field that made good browsing for the bees, the apiarists paid the farmers for permission to put their hives in the middle of the field, at which point their bees then got the honey. And although Mead didn't realize it, there was actually an externality in the other direction as well, because at some times of the years, the bees pollinate the plants and thus increase crop yields. And at those times of the year, the farmers pay the apiarists to put their hives in the middle of the field so as to pollinate their field. So it was a sort of a neat case where it was theoretically impossible, but in fact was not only practical, but routinely being done. So those are both examples of cases where in some form people deal with externalities. One way of putting it, one way I sometimes like to put it, is that another name for a market failure on the free market is a profit opportunity. The fact there's a market failure means there's something not being done that would produce net benefits. So if only you can figure out some clever way of doing it, you might be able to pocket some of those benefits. But none of this implies that market failures are not a problem on the free market, because all of these are things that might work or might not work. If bees weren't lazy, if you had it, so, or if farms were small enough so that the bees could fly across lots and lots of farms easily, then this solution wouldn't work. And you can think of lots of other examples where you have imperfect solutions to forms of market failure in the private market. And the result of those is that market failure is not as bad a problem as it at first seems when you think about it, but it is still a problem, and there will still be things that aren't produced. And I suppose probably the most convincing example for our society would probably be national defense, that it is very hard to defend me from somebody dropping an atomic bomb on my head without defending my neighbor from someone dropping an atomic bomb on his head. Therefore, defense against people who might bomb us is a public good in the normal sense, and it is at least difficult, perhaps not impossible, but difficult to think of ways in which in a modern society that particular public good could be privately provided. What I want to... So the implication, let me state it simply. The implication is that under a pure laissez-faire society where everything is organized through the free market, there will be some goods that fail to be produced, even though they would be worth producing. And there will be some goods or services that will be produced, even though they are not worth producing, even though their costs are larger than the benefits. And we thus have a less satisfactory outcome than we would have if the world was run by a perfectly wise and benevolent regulator. What I sometimes refer to as a bureaucrat god, somebody who, sort of a central planner who knows everything and has only our good at heart. We have, however, a striking shortage of bureaucrat gods in the real world. And the problem with this as an argument for replacing the market with government production or government regulation is that when you think about it a while, you realize that market failure exists in political markets as well. And let me give you a simple example. The question is, why would anybody expect democracy to work? All right. And what I think of as the sort of civics class model of democracy, the naive theory of how democracy works, is that the politicians have to do the right thing, because if they don't do the right thing, the voters will vote them out again. All right? That's sort of the basic theory. And in order for that to work, the voters have to know both what the politicians are doing and whether it's the right thing. This is not a trivial thing to find out, that for some odd reason, as far as I know, no congressman in the history of the U.S. has ever introduced a bill into Congress whose title is a bill to make farmers richer and city folk poorer. And yet, every year, agriculture bills which have that purpose are introduced into Congress. All right? That there's an obvious reason why, if you're introducing a bill that helps some people and hurts other people, you try to tell the people you help that it helps them, and you try to tell the people it hurts that it helps them too. So what that means, especially in the kind of very large and elaborate society we have, is that figuring out what the people you vote for are doing and whether they should do it takes a great deal of time and effort, and you may still get it wrong. All right? I mean, all of you have friends who disagree with you politically. Obviously, they got it wrong, right? And the question is, why should you go to all that time and effort? What do you get? What is the return if you decide to spend, 15 hours a week checking the voting record of the local congressman and looking at the arguments for and against what he's doing? It's not trivial, because after all, the congressman might vote against a good bill because he believes he can thus get a better bill. He might even vote against a good bill in exchange for someone else who was opposed to that bill voting for something important to him. So it's not like you can just sort of check things off and say he's a bad guy, he's a good guy. But suppose you are willing to go to all that time and effort, what do you get? Well, at the presidential level, your vote probably changes the chance that someone will win the election by somewhere vaguely around 1 part in 5 million. Given the size of the U.S. electorate, and if you look at how much people usually win or lose elections by, somewhere vaguely around 1 chance in 5 million your vote will affect it. How much work is it worth doing for 1 chance in 5 million that the better candidate will win? Not very much. Now, let's think about this for a minute. If the better candidate wins, and if better is defined not just in terms of your selfish interest, but in some general sense, then not only are you better off, but so are 300 million other people. So you might say, well, even at one chance in 5 million, if we're going to benefit 300 million people, it's worth doing. But of course, those 300 million people aren't you, right? What you are doing when you engage in the research to be an intelligent, rational, well-informed voter is producing a public good. The public good being an increased chance of the better candidate winning. And it's a public good because it produces a benefit to everybody who that candidate will be affecting, whether or not they contribute to producing the public good. All right? The result of this is what economists in the field refer to as rational ignorance. Rational ignorance is not knowing things when the price of learning them is higher than their value to you. And everyone is rationally ignorant about most things. All right? And should be, of course. And in particular, almost everybody is rationally ignorant about almost all the things they would need to know in order for the civics class model of democracy to work. All right? So that's one example where market failure strikes, as it were, at the very fundamentals of the political system that's supposed to get the government to do the right thing. Because the result of that is that people actually vote according to whether the guy sounds nice, or whether their neighbors like him, or whether he's got a good sound bite that appeals to them if they don't think very hard, and are very unlikely to vote on the basis of whether or not he's actually supporting good policies that will benefit. Let me try an experiment, which I've tried elsewhere. How many people in this room know the name of their congressional representative? Right. Yeah, you're a bunch of irrational people. I see a whole bunch of rational people who don't know. It's not you. You know, you might be a hobby of yours, of course, to study politics. But all the, I assume almost all of you are old enough to vote, since nowadays 18-year-olds vote, and most people at college are at least 18. Not everybody, but most people. I was interviewed by a girl at my college, freshman, who I think turned out to be 14, as I remember. Beat me by 2 years. But in any case, the implication of that is that that model of democracy can't work. And therefore that we're going to end up with, as we do end up with, a system where the incentives for politicians are A, to be in favor of anything that looks good if you don't think about it, and against anything that looks bad if you don't think about it, because the voters aren't thinking about it. And then beyond that, be in favor of those things that well-organized interest groups are willing to contribute to their campaigns if they're in favor of. To have a sort of a double-sided system. I think of it as a coarse control and a fine control on a microscope. And the coarse control is that you can't be in favor of everything that everybody knows is bad, whether or not they're right. And you've got to be in favor of anything that everybody knows is good, whether or not they're right. And the fine control is what special interest groups will offer what in order to get you to do things. And in fact, the interest groups are really quite interesting in terms of applying the public good theory to the political system. Because suppose we're considering a law, say an auto tariff. And the auto tariff will benefit auto companies and their workers, and will hurt almost everybody else. It'll hurt everybody who buys cars because it makes cars more expensive, and it will hurt everybody who produces export goods because trade is really a way of converting corn into Hondas. All right, we produce goods, send them abroad, get foreign things back. If you put up a tariff, we don't buy as many Hondas, we don't sell as much corn. However, the beneficiaries consist basically of a handful of auto companies and one big union. And maybe you could argue the mayor of Detroit, say. That's a small number of people, and with a small public, it's not too hard to produce a public good. If you've got something that only benefits 7 people, well, they get together and one of them says, look, I'll chip in this much to buy the tariff. You chip in this much, we'll all agree. We, therefore, will reward politicians who support the auto tariff. We'll get the auto tariff. And if we imagine, say, that the auto tariff is worth $10 billion a year to the car companies and the union, they can probably raise at least $1 billion or $2 billion to buy it. What about the victims? Well, the same auto tariff that benefits the car companies by $10 billion hurts the rest of us, let's say, by $20 billion. But the rest of us are a dispersed interest group of 300 million people minus the auto workers and the auto stockholders, so 298 million people or something. And there is no very practical way by which a group that large without any kind of coordination is going to be able to raise any significant fraction of what it's worth to them to stop the tariff. In fact, most of them won't even know that it's worth stopping a tariff because, for the same public good reason as I discussed before, it isn't worth finding out what things make you $100 poorer when finding out has almost no chance of letting you stop them. All right? So the rationally ignorant victims don't do anything, the rationally well-informed beneficiaries do. And the prediction that comes out of this, and I think it's one of the more reliable predictions of public choice theory, which is the application of economics to politics, is that the political tendency is to transfer from dispersed interest groups to concentrated interest groups, to have laws that benefit groups where the number of beneficiaries are small enough and well enough organized so that they can raise some fraction of what they're getting to make contributions to the politicians who do the things they like away from groups that are dispersed and therefore politically impotent. I think that's a moderately clear prediction of public choice theory. Let me give you an entirely different example of market failure in the public market. And this has to do with the question of how you get people to engage in long-term planning. How do you bear costs today that will produce benefits in 30 years or 40 years? And a very common charge against the free market is that companies are all short-sighted. And the simplest proof this isn't true is to go into a lumber yard and observe that there is black walnut lumber for sale. Because a black walnut is a very pretty kind of lumber, but the tree takes a long time to grow. It's a hardwood tree, not something like a pine tree that grows up in 10 or 15 years. Nonetheless, it's produced commercially. That most lumber comes from trees grown to be cut down. I should say, if anybody tells you, don't waste paper, we want to save the trees, he's got it exactly backwards. That's like somebody saying, be a vegetarian, we want to save the cows. If everybody's a vegetarian, there will be very few cows in the world. Because cows don't just happen. Cows are there because someone raised them to be slaughtered for meat. If we consume no paper, there will be fewer trees in the world, not more, because that paper is coming from tree farms where they are growing trees to make paper out of. All right. That was a digression. But going back, though, to the question of long-term planning, suppose it's going to take 40 years to grow black walnut trees until they can be harvested. And suppose you're a profit-making entrepreneur or businessman, but you're 60 years old. And you say to yourself, should I invest in buying land and planting black walnut trees? I'm probably not going to live to 100. Maybe I shouldn't. Then you're thinking, oh, sure I should. Of course I should. How are you going to make money out of your black walnut trees without having to live to 100? When you plant them, you're not getting by cutting them down. We're planting trees, they're going to take 40 years to grow, and then you can harvest them. What you do is, I say, in 20 years, I find somebody else who is 60 or maybe younger, and I say, look, I've got this field full of half-grown black walnut trees. That takes 20 years off the time it would take you to grow them, so I'll sell you that field, and you wait the second 20 years. All right? So the result is that people on the market, purely out of rational self-interest, can plan beyond their lifespan because they're able to make plans and then transfer the partly finished asset to somebody else later on. In order for that to work, however, the essential requirement is secure property rights. Suppose I'm planting these black walnut trees, but I happen to know that every year there is a 5% chance, every year at least towards the end when they're getting big, there's a 5% chance that some entrepreneur with no scruples will come onto my property at night with a chainsaw and a truck, cut down my trees and drive off. In that case, I will only invest in the black walnut trees if the price when they're finished is high enough to pay not only the interest on my investment, but my 5% a year chance of losing them. And if there's another 5% chance that at some point during that period the government will decide that black walnut trees are a national resource and seize them, then I've also got to make enough money out of my black walnut trees, if I do keep them, to cover the risk each year that they'll get nationalized. All right. So what is this saying? It is saying that in order for people to engage in long-term planning, they've got to have secure property rights. They've got to be reasonably sure that the things they start today will be theirs at the point in the future when they might want to transfer them to somebody else. Now let's think about governments. Political actors have very insecure property rights. As I used to say it a couple of presidents ago, Clinton could rent out the White House, but he couldn't sell it. If you are a politician and you do politically expensive things now because you in your wisdom know that in 40 years they will produce benefits that would be politically profitable, you have just taken a very stupid decision. Because long before those 40 years are out, your term is over. And if anybody benefits from your work, it's got a 50-50 chance to be the president of the other party. All right? If you actually look at people, look at the serious discussion of economic conditions when elections are coming out. Nobody worries about what the unemployment rate is going to be 8 years from now. What are they concerned about? The unemployment rate in November of this year and the unemployment rate in November 2 years later. All right? That's perfectly rational behavior for politicians. They don't have any secure ownership over their political resources. And so they have to be short-sighted. They have to say, we are only willing to do things which will give us political benefits in the short term. Now, they can, of course, claim to be far-sighted. They can try to get political benefits by telling the voters, what I'm doing is going to produce a big benefit in the distant future. But the voters aren't going to know whether it's true or false, and it probably isn't true, because that's what you're going to say whether it's true or not. Right? So the basic argument that I'm making then is that in this case and many others, I could give more examples, but I think I'm running a little bit low on time, if I'm not mistaken, that market failure on the political market means that governments will not, in fact, take the decisions that are worth taking, and therefore substituting political control of things for market control is likely to make your problems worse, not better. That's sort of the bottom line. Let me go on to, well, a little short of time, to say a little bit about the relevance of market failure outside both politics and what you usually think of as economics. And let me take a problem that probably some of you have faced and many of you will face. Suppose you are living with somebody, which could be a husband or wife, roommate, doesn't much matter. But suppose the terms you're living together are that you take turns cooking dinner. All right, not an unreasonable arrangement for those of us who cook. We then have two ways we could organize it. One of them is, I cook and I clean up, then you cook and you clean up. And the other is, I cook and since I'm tired after cooking, you clean up. You cook and since you're tired after cooking, I clean up. And the question is, which is the more sensible way of arranging it? And why? And you only get to answer if you actually cook. If you don't cook, you aren't in a position, you don't have the relevant specialized information. What? Cook and clean. Cook and clean. And the reason is that the amount of mess made is not a fixed product of cooking dinner. It is a product of how much you care not to make mess. All right? So if the other person is going to clean, well, it's really less trouble to use another pot for this part of it. And I've got 5 minutes while the water comes to a boil, so why don't I read a book or watch television instead of cleaning what I already messed up in the first part of cooking? So the basic argument is that if I cook and clean, then the costs of mess making are an internal cost, the cost I myself bear, and I take account of them. If I cook and he cleans, they're an external cost, and I am therefore likely to ignore them. So that's one very simple example, and I am suggesting that you want to apply that approach to lots. Let me give you one other example, and this is my solution, which I admit I've never actually implemented, to the silent student problem. And all professors in this room are familiar with the silent student problem. You come to the end of your perfectly lucid and clear explanation of some particular point in your field, and you say, now did everybody follow that? And no one says anything. And then 3 weeks later, you grade the midterm and discover what a mistake you made, that nobody, in fact, understands it. What happened? Each student says to himself, well, I didn't follow it, but the others might, and I'm really going to look stupid. If I say I don't understand that, please explain it again. And not only will that shame me in front of the other students, the professor might remember that I was stupid and give me a worse grade on the grounds that I wasn't paying attention in class. So I won't say anything. So my solution to this problem is a technological solution, which is I have not implemented. And the idea is that in each classroom, you have at each student's place a button on the floor which can be unobtrusively pushed with the foot. And at the back of the classroom, there is a sign which shows how many buttons are pushed. And when I come to the relevant point, I say, now, will everybody who followed my explanation of the principle of comparative advantage, please press your button. And the number 3 appears on the screen, and I go back and explain it again. All right, well, that's an attempt to eliminate market failure by a slight tweak in the organization. All right. Notice that in designing firms, what it really means is, so far as possible, trying to set up the rules of the firm so that the reward individuals get is proportioned to the amount of benefit they produce to the firm, which really means decentralizing where you can. And you can't always decentralize. Notice, as a general characteristic of economics, at least done right, that I'm applying the same assumptions to everybody. That I am applying assumptions of rational, self-interested behavior to businessmen, to politicians, to voters, to husbands, to wives, even to students and professors. Self-interested does not mean selfish. That most of us care some about people other than ourselves. All it means is that each individual has his own set of objectives, seeing the world out of his own eyes, and each of us acts to try to achieve his objectives, and mine and yours are not identical. And given that, and given that individuals rationally try to achieve those objectives, from that you can build up economics. That's what it's about. Economics is not about prices, it's not about unemployment, it's not about the economy. Economics is about understanding behavior from the assumption that individuals act rationally. Thank you.